I'm recording. Good afternoon, Dr. Jones.
Dr. Worrell, good to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm with the Natural Law Institute, and today is the 13th of March. And I'm going to sit down with Professor Jones and have a nice little chat. I'm interested in his recent work, the Logos Rising, which I found to be an exceptional work, which is not exceptional for your work, Professor, but it's exceptional in its content and its scope, and I found it to be exceptionally valuable.
Thank you.
Your work is something to me. I tell people that I think you write faster than I read, and you're taking an increasing amount of my shelf space, which I appreciate. All the work you do, for the audience, the work that Dr. Jones does is quite interesting. It's historic and presented in a literary fashion that is engaging. It's quite gripping. I don't read literature, but this reads like literature of the most gripping nature because it's true human stories.
Well, thank you. Actually, I probably was inspired by those great American historians like Francis Parkman, who this is considered literature of the 19th century. His book on the Jesuits in North America is just a moving, great piece of history. But it's also it's a gripping story. And that's what I think impressed me. It wasn't just Parkman, although he was certainly influential. William Prescott's Conquest of Mexico is an incredibly compelling book. It's a story of Cortez showing up in Mexico and the battle with Montezuma and so on and so forth. It will never happen again in human history. Okay, there's only one time that something like that could happen, and Prescott had it. So I think I was inspired by those books, which are, I think, both they're literature, but they're history, but they're also literary history.
And like I say, it's an unusual combination, and I do hold it in high regard. I will admit to being a little bit intimidated to sit with you because your breadth and scope of knowledge is extensive.
Well, thank you.
And so what I wanted to do for the Natural Law Institute is regarding this work, Logos Rising, is to try to syncretize our conversation between you and the Natural Law Institute, because we are on the same path. Although the language that we use is, we avoid theological and philosophical. We tend toward operational language that is testimonial in its nature. We don't claim to talk about God. And many of the things you talk about in Logos Rising are coming from a theological, philosophical point of view.
No, everything in there is from a theological, philosophical point of view.
I would say that's accurate.
And the reason. So how did I come upon this? I did a book called The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, in which I said that the Jews, when they killed Christ, they just killed the Logos incarnate. And when you attempt to destroy Logos, you're just trying to destroy the order of the universe. And people want to destroy the order of the universe are known as revolutionaries. And that's where you get the Jewish revolutionary spirit. So the term Logos was essential to that book. And then I realized I hadn't defined it. I hadn't really talked about it. I assumed everybody knew what I was talking about. And over that period of time between Logos Rising and the Jewish revolutionary spirit, I spent a lot of time in Iran. And this was a group of people who obviously are not Christian. It's a very interesting place because they are Islamic, but they are not the same as the majority of Muslims. They are called Shia as opposed to Sunni. And it largely means that they did not give up their Persian identity when they didn't convert to Islam. They were conquered by the Arabs. And so there is this tension there between theology, between Islam and traditional Persian culture, that you have to get to know the people before this comes out. Because at this moment, we are still under the reign of the revolution of the Islamic Revolution of 1979, and that's still officially the government. But if you go deeper, you start to realize that there is an undercurrent of Persian culture, which has preserved that identity. They never gave up their language. They never gave up Farsi. The North Africans all gave up their language. Egypt, nobody speaks Egyptian anymore. They all speak Arabic there. And so they were subsumed into Islam in a way that Persia was not. And so a lot of these discussions that I had in Iran were based on just reason. We don't share any of the theological tenets of the religion. We can't. And I ran into this early on. Early on, I was we were in Tehran. I was taken to Qom and introduced to one of the mullahs there. And I'm thinking, well, what are we going to talk about? So I said, let's talk about sex. Okay. Is there a logos to sex? And the discussion goes back and forth. We're going nowhere. And at one point he says, just because you start the Coke doesn't mean you have to finish the Coke. And I'm just kind of scratching my head. I go, what does that mean? And at that point, the cameraman jumped in and said, that's not true. That's wrong. So the cameraman got into a debate with the mullah. The cameraman knew more about sex and logos than the mullah did. And so then the discussion got continued. When I was in Mashhad, the same mullah shows up and he wants to talk about faith and reason. Okay, that's good. I like to talk about faith and reason. I think it's an important discussion. So I start, Mashhad is farther to the north and east. It's actually on the Silk Road. The Eurasian plain is there. And this is where the wheel was invented.
Mm.
And so I said, let's talk about the wheel. And I started to talk about, have to have a flat area. You can blah, 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 blah. It shows up in tombs. And I said, this is how the wheel got invented. And the mullah interrupts me in the middle of it and says, no, that's not true.
Huh.
I said, what do you mean it's not true? He said, no, a prophet explained how to build the wheel. I said, a prophet? Wait a minute. We're talking about 10,000 BC here. And Islam didn't come into existence in Iran, certainly, until 600, 700. That's a long time. How is that possible? And he said, well, he couldn't explain it, but I finally understood what he was talking about, because they believe that the Quran is the source of all knowledge. Well, this is a corollary of that. If the Quran is the source of all knowledge, then if you want to build a wheel, it has to come from the Quran. Well, there is nothing in the Quran about the wheel. Oh, wait a minute. We'll go to the Hadith, which are the commentaries on the Quran, and that explains. Well, I said, wait a minute, this is impossible. We're not going to get anywhere here, because first of all, I'm not a Muslim. I don't accept the premises of the Quran, and that's your scripture. The Hadith or commentary on the scripture, which don't have canonical value. So the discussion completely broke down. That's going to go nowhere. If you take it's basically a bad case of sola scriptura.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a Protestant principle, but the Muslims have it much, much. So at that point, after having that experience, I thought, well, we have to have another approach here if we're going to talk to each other. And that's what led me to lead to Logos Rising.
Fascinating. I kind of find this conversation reminds me of the Logos Rising issue. Goes back to the biblical story where I started studying Hebrew because I wanted to know more about this word in the Bible, this literary image called the bush. And I note two bushes in the Bible, one of which is the bush which allowed Abraham to discover the existence of the good God, and the other one, which is the cell phone that Moses used to talk to God.
The burning bush.
That's right. And the I'm truncating the story a little bit, but the construction of the existence of a good God lends itself to the question of theodicy. for the audience, the theodicy is the question, why is there evil in the world? And there's two answers. And north and west of Jerusalem, the people say, the existence of evil in the world is the failure of human beings to obey the good God or follow the good God. And the other answer in the rest of the world is, it's God's will, which is a dualistic approach. And so this is like the beginning in my understanding of goes to Augustine's work with the city of God, which the acceptance of our personal responsibility to follow the good rules, to follow God, or to live in the city of man, which is that absent morals in the dualistic approach. It's kind of a selfish approach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think the crucial theodicy is Genesis. It's the book of Genesis, which is the book of beginning. And so in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That's a metaphysical beginning. The Quran doesn't have a beginning. The Quran, the first surah of the Quran is a prayer on mercy. It's a Syriac Christian prayer. So it doesn't have a beginning. But the Bible does. And part of the Bible, part of Genesis is the story of Joseph. And the story of Joseph is theodicy. I mean, that's the fundamental theodicy in the Bible, and I think in the world. And so basically the fundamental problem is evil. How do you talk about evil? If God is all powerful, why doesn't he stamp out evil? If he's all good, either God is powerless to stop evil, or he's evil himself and he's not all good. So you're kind of on the horns of a dilemma generally if you're talking to the village atheist, because that's the argument that they use. It's the most powerful argument for atheism, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But Genesis deals with it right at the beginning, and it's the story of Joseph. And Joseph is the favorite son of the father's favorite son, but his brothers hate him. And they're jealous, and they decide to kill him. And one of the brothers says, no, let's just sell him, throw him into a cistern, we'll sell him into slavery. And they do. And he ends up in Egypt. And he, because he's a bright guy, he gets to the top of the bureaucracy just in time to save his brothers, because famine has broken out in Israel. And they have to come to the granaries of Egypt, because otherwise they're going to starve to death. And at that point, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. And this is the theodicy. It comes at the very end of Genesis, which I think is significant, where he's back again talking to his brothers. And he says, the evil that you intended to do to me has been turned by God's power into good. That's the theodicy. Because God has to allow evil, because he created man with free will. And you can't have free will and the inability to do evil. If that were the case, you'd be an animal. And animals cannot do evil because they cannot do good. So there's, salmon have sex. They don't choose sex partners. It's chemicals go off in their brain. Higher mammals have estrus, and they just act according to their hormones.
Right.
But man has to make a choice. And because he makes a choice, there's a higher good involved. And so if he makes a choice and he chooses evil, well, then how do you, well, God is there to turn evil into good. And that is one of the profoundest powers of God. And that's, you have to understand that if you want to understand human history.
Right. So I go further in this vein to the issue is free will, which many people are actively decrying. And it's a fascinating thing, because I find it to be just a crazy conversation, but they're essentially dualists, and they want to believe in the enslaved will.
Well, the big man in that regard was Luther.
Yes.
And he wrote a book called The Enslaved Will, De Servo Arbitrio. So when you get into this realm, there's no point in talking about ontology or theology. You're talking about psychology here. And that's the only way to get into the mind of Luther at this point. And what happened at this point is he finally succumbed. He could never control his passions. And so instead of admitting that and just going to confession, he decided he's going to make a religion out of the fact that he can't control his passions. And nobody can control their passions. If I can't do it, nobody can. And the crucial point at this point was the fact that he had just married the nun, Catalina von Bora. And in doing that, they both broke their vow of celibacy. They both were involved in the rationalization of sin. That is the worst thing that you can do. It's the worst thing you can do in this life. I think that's the sin against the Holy Spirit, because you can't be forgiven if you're constantly rationalizing your sin. You have to say, I did something wrong. That's where it came from. And it's still a powerful force. So you have, I don't know, it was one of these recent atheists or somebody. There's no such thing as free will.
It's a professor out of Berkeley, I think, and I can't think
of it. Yeah, some guy. So wait a minute. This is an interesting point. So were you determined to say that? If you were, were you biologically determined to say that? Well, if so, why should I believe you? Why is that? Why is that a valid testimony? It's a self-refuting testimony, because we all know that we have free will. It's one of the obvious facts of data of human existence. And if you want to escape it, I probably have the better explanation for what you're doing than you do. And it's probably because you're burdened with guilt. And you want to get out from the guilt without admitting that you did something wrong. And so everybody does it. And so there's no free will. That's the same rationale that Luther had.
Yeah, it's justificationism.
Yeah.
Very interesting. That this broached the subject of this. One I wanted to discuss with you is the Trinity as a function, which is not something I've spent a great deal of time studying. But it relates to a function that we've detected in the Natural Law Institute of we call the ternary logic of the universe, which is seemingly related. The ternary logic is something exists, then something is attracted to that by being opposite and creates a union of something that has emergent potential. Yeah. And that would be like an electron and a proton creating an atom.
It's also Hegel's dialectic. It's the dialectic. That's exactly what the dialectic is. Hegel didn't invent the term. He got it from Fichte. And it's a profound term. It's a profound term. All of the German idealists were Protestant theology students. They were all studying theology at the time of the Enlightenment. Hegel was born in 1770. The great experience of his life was the French Revolution.
Yes.
And of course, the Enlightenment leading up to the French Revolution. And he's wondering, is it possible to express the truths of Christianity in scientific terms, what he would call scientific terms? And I think that's what the phenomenology is. It's basically attempt. And I think that the dialectic is a powerful transposition of the experience of human life, the experience of redemption, and also an experience of the Trinity. It kind of makes the Trinity seem more plausible to the Enlightenment mind. That's where I think that idea comes from.
It's Trinitarian, though, and I don't know how it's like the way I saw it, and I made some notes to try to pattern my discussion with you a little bit. The in my limited understanding of the Trinity is the stumbling block for me, which is the Creator, the created, and the emergent potentials. Is that?
No, that's not right, because this is the problem that the Arians had. Okay. So what you have at the scriptural, you have two terms. It's son, the son, and logos. These are two important terms in. So what does it mean to be the son of God? Because that term comes repeatedly,
right,
in the scriptures. Well, we all know what the son is, and the son presupposes the father, obviously. And Jesus would refer to the father. So he has a father-son relationship with God. Jesus has a father-son relationship with God.
Okay.
Okay, so Arius, the heretic, took this and ran with it and said, basically, if Jesus is the son of the father, then the father obviously precedes the son, obviously. And if the father precedes the son, there is a time when the son was not. If there was a time when the son was not, he was a creature. And if he's a creature, he cannot be God. And this was the discussion that just racked the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, we're talking about probably the fourth century, the time of the great councils, where they hammered out the understanding of the relationship of the father to the son, and that came up with the concept of the idea of Trinity. It was a discussion that took place totally in Greek. The Latin fathers were pretty much excluded from this discussion because you had to speak Greek to understand this, and it came down to the difference between one letter and two words. Is it homoousion, which is like the father? Or is it homoousion, which is one in being with the father? And the Arians chose like the father. And the Orthodox, the Catholic understanding, was one in being with the father. That has become the Orthodox position. That is a crucial, I spent a lot of time in Logos Rising talking about the significance of this. It was one of those earth-shaking things that you had to get right. You had to get it right. And if you didn't get it right, the train of Logos left the station without you. And the first group of people that got left behind were the heretics, the Arians, the Nestorians, and then the second group that got left behind were the Muslims, because their Christology basically came from the Nestorians, who did not believe that Jesus Christ was true God and true man. So it was a crucial moment in theology. Look, the reason I chose the word logos is because logos, in a sense, explodes the difference between philosophy and theology. Now, I'm not saying that there is no difference, but I'm saying that logos has a foot in both of those camps. And we have an exaggerated understanding, probably based on the idea of the separation of church and state, that there's a radical difference between philosophy and theology. If you're asking me what I think, I would go back to the prologue to the Gospel of St. John. Okay. Is that theology? Well, it's certainly revelation. It's obviously revelation.
Yep.
So we're talking about a beginning here. This is a mirror image of the beginning of Genesis. Genesis says, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth." St. John, now, because of Paul's bad experience at the Areopagus, where he tried to talk to the Greek philosophers and as if they were idol worshippers, and they were all offended by that, and they walked out on them. He began, unlike the other three evangelists who began with Hebrew genealogies, which made no sense to Greeks. They don't care. Who are these people? I don't know any of them.
Right.
St. John said, in the beginning, there was logos. Now, is that theology or is that metaphysics? I think it's both. And then it says, and logos was with God. Now, that's theology. That is the basis of the Trinity. If you want to understand the Trinity, you have to understand that sentence. So there is, and then the third sentence which is probably should, who am I? But it seems to me it should have been the second sentence. But anyway, it's who am I to revise St. John? I'm like Thomas Jefferson. I'm just going to rewrite the Bible here. But anyway, the third sentence is, and Logos is God, Kai Logos and Theos. Now that is that philosophy or is that theology? I think that there, I can't tell the difference.
Yeah, that's it goes to the same, it's the kernel of the same, both this go to the same kernel.
And I'm saying that that is a sentence that just changed the world.
Mm.
The world was never the same after that. Because you establish parameters. Now, Jordan Peterson, who's the world's smartest goy, gave a speech in Ephesus, which is where St. John and St. Paul and the Blessed Mother were living in a certain period of time. And he said, they believe that the beginning was chaos. No, they didn't. I mean, again, the world's smartest goy doesn't understand the difference between the Gospel of St. John and Hesiod. This is Greek. This is unredeemed Greek mythology.
Hmm.
Hesiod's cosmogony. In the beginning was chaos. No, this is exactly the opposite of what St. John is saying. There has never been a time when there was chaos.
Hmm.
Never. Because there's always been this fundament of logos, which is God's presence in the world and our understanding of reason. Logos, vernunft, what Hegel would call vernunft. And not only when he said logos is God.
Right.
Now, we all knew, everybody knew that there was a rational basis to the universe.
Right.
I mean, you had the beginnings of this with Greek philosophy. Thales said it was water. There's some fundamental principle. And finally, Heraclitus, who also came from Ephesus, by the way, is an important town. He was the first one to use logos as the fundamental principle. So we all knew that. But at this point, you're saying it's a person. Logos is a person.
Okay.
Well, that means that's an act, someone who can act. And that means that logos is an activity that proceeds throughout human history with God in charge. And that is a fundamental difference from certainly what the Greeks believe. It's implicit in the Hebrew scriptures. It's obviously implicit in the Hebrew scriptures. But it's not philosophically explicit in the way that the Greeks did it. And that was this, what created Christianity. You basically had the Hebrews had a history without a philosophy, and the Greeks had a philosophy without a history, and now they merge together in Christianity, and you have both. And that's, I think, precisely what Hegel understood in a profound way, that we were now beyond the realm of Platonism, which basically saw the world divided into two. There's the realm of eternal forms, which never change. And there's the world of experience, which is nothing but change, and you can't figure it out. And so in that sense, thought or art in particular is taking a form from that realm and imposing it on inchoate matter. So you take a triangle, and then you get a rectangle, and then you get a circle. You make the circles into pillars. You put the rectangle on top of the pillars, you got a beam, and you put a triangle on, you got a cornice, and that's art. It's the imposition of those forms, and that, in a sense, crippled art for a millennium, for more than a millennium, because that does not correspond to what we just said about Christianity, because there is a living presence in Christianity. Neither Plato nor Aristotle understood that there was a creator. Neither one understood that. And this is now, we're telling you specifically that it's a creator. And the man who really understood that in a profound way was Aquinas.
Right.
Who talked about the eternity of the world. And he said, even if the world is eternal, It had to come into being. Now, that is a very subtle statement. That is extremely subtle. And you, the more you think about it, you realize, yeah, that's absolutely true. But it's hard to distinguish between time and being.
Yes.
You need abstract thought to do that. And the Hebrews were never abstract. Their language is not abstract, as you probably found out when you started studying Hebrew.
I'm no great student of it, by the way.
Well, Greek is very abstract. And logos is an abstract concept that we need to understand being, the attributes of being.
Yeah, no, that's kind of the I'm trying to unravel my thoughts here a little bit. The construction of its goodness, right? We make goodness or we make badness. And the Western civilization under the church was able to move much faster in its production of goodness than the rest of the world. And you would, I think, say it was due to the expression of logos, which you map the progress of logos through the world in your book. We would understand it that it is the proper balancing of human influences in operation of the civilization, which is there's only three basic influences a human can generate in construction of anything, which is I can try to convince you, which we relate to religious or feminine function, cause you to do something by convincing you. We can use brute force, which is the masculine methodology. That's force. And then we can make a commercial agreement, which is the commerce we trade.
Okay. I think you're working from an understanding of the good that is subjective. And I would say there is nothing subjective about the good. There are three transcendental. Now we're talking about the characteristics of being.
Yes.
And being and God. God is a subsistent being. He's a being that is not dependent on anyone else.
Right.
It is totally a self-subsistent being.
Yes.
So, all right, you want to talk about his characteristics. And they're known as transcendentals. And so it's the good, the true, and the beautiful.
Okay.
And anytime you are dealing with these things in your life, you're in the presence of God.
Okay.
And so what's good is, the question with good is, how do we achieve the good? How do we achieve it through our actions? You have to understand the moral law, which is basically a description of successful actions that will lead you to the good. Or the negative would be the Ten Commandments, which is these are bad actions that will lead you away from the good. Okay? The other question is, how do we apprehend what is true? Okay?
Right.
So the good, how do you achieve the good? That's called practical reason. And the science of practical reason is morality. If you're talking about the true, it's called pure reason. And you don't, the goal of pure reason is the truth. The goal of practical reason is the good. And then the final thing you have is beauty.
Right.
Which is also a transcendental characteristic of God. And this is, I think, the most interesting aspect of it. Because when you're in the presence of beauty, you're in the presence of God.
Okay.
And people don't quite understand that. People tend to just, let's just talk about the good, or let's just talk about the truth. So good is morality. We need that. Truth is science. We need that. Beauty, nobody understands it. Nobody understands it as a transcendental. And I'm saying that's why I wrote the Dangers of Beauty, my book on aesthetics, because it's just as important as morality and science, just as important. And if you're in the presence of the beautiful, you're in the presence of God. And the thing about beauty is that it's probably the fastest way to put you in the presence of God. Because philosophy requires powers of abstraction that most people don't have.
Yep.
And morality requires self-discipline that most people don't have. And so you have failures along the way, but pretty much anybody can be impressed by beauty. So if you go to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome and you walk inside, you cannot be unaffected by that. You are overwhelmed. This is a sign you're in the presence of beauty, where you just kind of stop and you just stare. As this happened to me, the aesthetic experiences in my life have always been the same. I had that experience when I saw the Taj Mahal. You have to go a mile where you can't have a car, any gas engine. You either sit in a camel cart or you walk the way. You come to a big building, which is beautiful in itself, which is the gateway. And you walk through that gateway and you see everything all at once. Everything. And the most beautiful orderly garden leading up to the most beautiful orderly building that I've ever seen. So it's unity in multeity. And that's exactly the experience of God. So you have a perfect fusion of existence and essence. So it's real, but it's really organized. So you can look out the window and that's real, or you can do geometry and that's really organized. But if you have geometry that's alive, that's beauty. And that's what you perceive, and that puts you in the presence of God, because that's what God is. So he is absolute existence and absolute essence in a way that you can't distinguish it. And it is so powerful that you will be content to stare at that for eternity. It's called the beatific vision because it's so beautiful. You will never exhaust that beauty.
Very well. But that. I didn't know how this conversation would go, and it's not.
I didn't either.
It's not going as I expected it by any
means. Well, take it back to what you expect.
No, it's okay. You know, it's okay. It's very gratifying to get a sense of your understanding.
So if you're talking about natural law, you're talking about logos, which are truths that can be apprehended by reason alone.
Yes.
You don't
yes.
need any type of supernatural revelation.
That's
everything
right.
That I've said today can be apprehended by natural reason.
We agree.
I can also draw the boundary where you can't go any farther. So you can't know anything. You can know that God exists.
Yes.
And if you reject that, then you got a psychological problem. And this is the argument that I dealt with the four atheists. They all have psychological problems. Christopher Hitchens is the most obvious. His atheism is a function of his relationship with his father, compounded by all of his immoral actions in his life. And that's so if you're dealing with an atheist, you don't talk about ontology, you talk about psychology.
Okay? Right. So part of the project of the Natural Law Institute is to complete Aquinas's work, which was not completed, in that it fails to account for human behavior. And what we have attempted to do, and I think we've done a good job, is to describe human behavior in terms of first causes.
Right.
To explain these things. So I'm going to back up two steps, because you said something about this good as a subjective, and it everybody thinks they're doing good. Some people are doing better than other people at being good. And they are closer to the logos, because their behavior is in accordance with the design.
everyone, you cannot act unless the goal of your action is the good. That's the only way you can act. You are determined. You are absolutely determined to choose the good. It's called synderesis. It's the principle. Okay.
Wait, spell that for me. That's an unusual word.
S-Y-N-D-E-R-E-S-I-S. Okay, so you're determined to choose the good. Let's refine it. You choose the greatest apparent good.
Now, that's synderesis.
Yeah, and that means that there's a subjective element to this, because it's the good as you understand it. Now, if you have if your mind is deranged by bad habits, you're still going to choose what you think is the good, but it won't be the good.
That's right.
It will be your delusion that it's the good. And so, if you're an alcoholic, the supreme good is having a drink. Now, there is nothing wrong with wine, but you have to regulate it by reason. If you don't regulate it by reason, by logos, then it will become a bad thing. And it will lead you away from the good, and you'll end up getting drunk, and you'll wake up in the morning with a hangover. But you chose what you thought was good. It's just that you didn't keep the good. You didn't have a full perception of the good because you didn't align it with reason. And the virtue that allows you to align this with reason is called temperance.
Yes.
It's one of the four cardinal virtues.
Our conversation is wide, and it's difficult for me to make the gaps. Make Bridget the
I'm trying to close the gap.
I appreciate that.
I'm trying to close the gap between theology and philosophy, but there's going to be a bump on the road. A bump on the road, which means, and what I'm saying is this, that Augustine, you mentioned Augustine earlier, was a Platonist, and he was going to achieve the good by, what's the word? The word fails me. Otium liberale. So leisure. Leisure. Muse is the word that the Germans use. Leisure. He's going to separate himself from the world of flux. He's going to contemplate the forms, which are the attributes of the divine, and he's going to rise to the realm of divine forms. That's the Platonic religion. Well, it didn't work. And he understood that it didn't work because he was held down by his concupiscence. He had bad sexual habits. He had a mistress. He was held bound to the earth by these vices. And then he started to realize, well, wait a minute. I don't need to rise anymore because Jesus Christ came down. And so he gave up the project of otium liberale. He gave up the Platonic project. And that's the bump that I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Because he had to realize you can't do it on your own. You can't do that. You can't philosophize your way into heaven. I'm a big fan of philosophy, okay? But you can't philosophize your way into heaven. You can philosophize your way to it's called the preamble of the faith. That's what the natural law is. It leads you to the door. And I have classic examples of this. I did a piece on Nathaniel Hawthorne. I did my doctoral dissertation on Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good man. I mean, especially considering a novelist, considering the jerks that novelists were generally in the 20th century. He was a family man, raised his children properly, was trying to live the best life he could in Puritan or congregational New England, wrote the biography of Millard Fillmore, made, he appointed him then consul in Liverpool, where he made enough money to take his family to Rome for a year, maybe a little more than a year. So he shows up in Rome. This is a, Henry James said he was provincial. He had never been out of a New England village. And a church in New England is this kind of white clapboard, you know, congregational thing, which is, you know, nice in its way, but not really all that inspiring. Suddenly he's in Rome. And not only is he in Rome, he goes to St. Peter's Basilica. And he walks into St. Peter's Basilica and he, I've never seen anything, because no one has ever seen anything like that before. It's an absolutely stunning aesthetic experience. And what I just said is, when you see beauty, you're in the presence of God.
Right.
So he's suddenly in the presence of God in a way he had never been before in his entire life. Now, this is the man who wrote The Scarlet Letter.
Right.
Which is a novel about what happens when you can't go to confession. Because there's no sacramental confession in the Puritan Church. And as a matter of fact, you have to be a saint in order to be a member of the Puritan Church. It's a visible elect on earth. So you're a saint. And what happens when the saint commits adultery? Well, he's got a problem. And that's precisely the problem. That's the depth of psychology that Hawthorne showed in The Scarlet Letter. So now here's the author of The Scarlet Letter. Not only goes into St. Peter's, he walks up to the confessional. And he sees people coming out, describes in detail, you know, the sorrow, the relief that they feel from being unburdened of his sins. And he starts to walk to the confessional and he stops. And an Italian comes out and he suddenly says, you know, wait a minute, I can't go to a church that's run by Italians. It was ethnic prejudice. There's nothing more than ethnic prejudice. And so that's the step I'm talking about there. It's the same step in a different mode that I talked about with Augustine. There's a certain step that you have to take where you're stepping beyond the bounds of reason.
Oh, I see. Right. No, and we would talk.
And you have to accept it by faith. And I'm saying this is the connection. This is the bump in the road. And I had the experience with an Iranian woman. We had long conversations. I said, I don't want to be the representative of Christianity. I don't want you to be the representative of Islam. Let's just talk. You know, let's just be honest with each other. Let's be truthful. Right. And we talked about Logos. And to a certain point, she said, you convinced me. I believe in Logos. Okay, I'm not sure what that means, but I believe in it. And then another instance where we're saying, you know, she's in exile, basically. She's disconnected from her own people. She's living in France, which has its own temptations, wine being one of them. Muslims are not supposed to drink wine. But she's not a Muslim anymore, so what are the new boundary lines? And she gets in trouble, and she's feeling bad. And she says to me, well, what now? I said, well, you must be baptized. And she blew up at me.
Oh.
She said, you lied to me. You said it was Logos, and now you're talking about water on my forehead? That's going to make a difference? This is, you know, and our relationship broke down at that point.
Yeah.
And I guess I wasn't, I want to be perfectly clear. That's why I brought Hawthorne into the story. You can walk, you got to take that step.
Right.
Beyond reason. I am the last guy in the world to denigrate reason. I'm a reason guy. I wrote the book called Logos Rising. So I'm a firm believer in reason and that Logos is God. But there's a certain step you have to take.
There we go. This brings us back to the free will.
What's that? Yeah, free will, right.
Brings us to the free will. Agency. You have to display agency.
So I want to make that clear. And we're never going to get away from it. So what you had with Hegel was an attempt to basically come up with a rational explanation of the Trinity. Now, the Trinity is the epitome of Logos and rationality.
Okay.
But not according to your mind, because your mind is not powerful enough to plumb the depths. Your line is that long. And God is really deep, and you're never going to...
Well, no, I agree with that. No, I'm not even trying to do that.
when you drop your line into those depths, all you're measuring is the length of your line.
Well, we agree. We agree. Now, the one of the this turns the conversation a little bit. The we talk about how humans express themselves, and with precision of language. And we see we call deflationary language. Ultimate deflationary language is mathematics, which we can compress a great deal of meaning into a small place. But ultimately, it's not predictive in its own way. And then we go towards philosophy, theology, and mysticism, which are increasingly inflated in their understanding.
Okay, the crucial turning point is metaphysics, because Aristotle said a synonym of metaphysics is theology. So when you're talking about being qua being, you're talking about God, and that's so it qualifies as theology. Metaphysics is not revelation.
Right.
It's natural theology. They didn't have any sense of, the Greeks didn't have any sense of revelation. Hebrews had it. Because Moses would talk to God face to face. So obviously they knew that there was some type of revelation. Obviously something's being handed down from some superior being, like the Ten Commandments when he walks down off the mountain. But the Greeks didn't have that sense. They didn't have that sense. They knew there was an uncaused cause and there was an unmoved mover. That's what Aristotle said. Plato tried to claim that this was a person who was concerned. They called him the Demiurgos. But that's the end of philosophy. They couldn't reconcile those two things. The only thing that reconciled those two things was the Trinity and the arrival of Jesus Christ. Because at this point you had, how do you have a transcendental being who cares about you?
Yes.
Transcendental beings are in the realm of forms with triangles and stuff like that. That's eternal. You're living in time. Yeah. How can a transcendental being have agency in time? It can't. And that was a dilemma. It ended with either the uncaused cause, which is definitely eternal, definitely yeah. transcendental, but doesn't care about you. Might not even be a person. And on the other hand, you have the Demiurgos, who certainly cares about you. But if he's in the realm of time, he's not God. He's not transcendent. That was the dead end of Greek philosophy. They could not resolve that issue, and it was only resolved when John wrote the gospel and said, Logos is God, with all of the implication of that. That resolved the dilemma of Greek philosophy, and it resolved it basically by revelation. Coming down, you don't have enough, you're not smart enough, I'll let you in on the real secret, I being God, I'll let you understand that. And it's called the Trinity.
Very good. I don't have much to ask you at this moment, and I certainly do appreciate the effort you put in and your time.
Well, good. I think we had a good discussion, good meeting of the minds. I hope your people feel the same way. If you get questions, share them with me and I'll try and answer them.
Will do. Now, I want to thank you, Professor Jones.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Great. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Thank you.